watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The poisoning and destruction of our environment is a global emergency. It has impacts that range from individual health to the persistence of life as we know it on this planet. The decisions about what happens in those arenas are increasingly governed by the bottom line of corporations and their investors. The institutions that are supposed to work in the public interest have been correspondingly weakened as they come under escalating corporate influence and control. Lies, self-dealing, and other corrupt practices permeate the processes that shape public policy. In the first part of the program tonight, we're going to focus on an urgent local issue, the effort to stop the destruction of the Finger Lakes National Forest by oil and gas drilling. Then, for the rest of the program, we'll present a panel of scientists, scholars, and advocates in the field of public health who will discuss how corporate money in scientific research is being used to manipulate results to the detriment of public health and safety. The Finger Lakes region of New York State is one of the most beautiful places on Earth, and it's our home. Many of the people in this community have rejected career advancement to remain here. Others of us have fled places destroyed by greed and exploitation and come here seeking a place truly fit for sane human living. Our region is poor in the monetary sense and as a result is often the target of corporate interests, happy to trash our communities to make themselves a profit and then leave us holding the bag. The latest such effort is a proposal to drill for oil and natural gas in the Finger Lakes National Forest near the town of Hector, located at the most beautiful part of Seneca Lake. The U.S. Forest Service has prepared a draft environmental impact statement listing five alternatives in response to the proposal of several drilling companies. Only one of these, alternative number four, bars any version of drilling in the national forest. National forests, unlike national parks, are designated for so-called mixed use. In practice, this means that private corporations can and do take advantage of public lands to get low-cost mineral leases. They reap the profits and leave the rest of us having to pay for the infrastructure and clean up the mess through our tax dollars. These are the alternatives as listed in the Forest Service's Environmental Impact Statement. The proposal is that 13,251 acres of federal oil and gas would be available for lease, and that 5,500 acres would be available for surface occupancy. Now, surface occupancy refers to the machinery, the pumps, the drills, the wells, the roads, the trucks, the other infrastructure involved in the drilling for oil and gas. When they refer to the acres of, quote, federal oil and gas, they're referring to the subsurface rights, the ground underneath the surface. Okay, these are the five alternatives. Number one, that 16,000 acres of federal oil and gas would be available for lease and that 9,800 acres would be available for surface occupancy. Alternative two, which is labeled here in this report as the, quote, preferred alternative, and I wonder preferred by whom, is that 16,000 acres, the entire national park's subsurface would be available for exploration and that 2,400 on the surface would be available for occupancy. Alternative number three is that the entire subsurface area of the park be available and that 0 acres would be available for surface occupancy. What this means is that wells would be directionally drilled from adjoining private land down into the land underneath the forest. Alternative number 4 is the no drilling option. No occupancy on the surface, no drilling into the subsurface. And alternative number 5 is that all of the subsurface would be available to drilling, with about 5,500 acres on the top available for surface occupancy. 3 out of 5 involve some sort of facilities on the surface inside the park itself, which means the cutting down forest and replacing it with equipment, machinery, wellheads, and roads. Another alternative encourages people to demolish the surrounding lands, homes, and farms to place this equipment there in order to diagonally drill into the land underneath the national forest. The decision as to which of these options will be implemented is in the hands of the Forest Service. The Forest Service is soliciting public comment. Please get something to write with. We'll be giving out an address to send comments to the Forest Service a little later in the program. Our comments must be in by August 1st, and they must be in writing. Community members, as well as local, state, and federal representatives, have all come out in favor of alternative number 4, the no drilling alternative. Last week, a rally by community members opposed to drilling was held at the ranger station in the National Forest. Chris Sturr was there.
Okay, why don't we start by having you just say who you are and what your affiliation is?
My name is John Compton. I'm a local Hector resident affiliated with the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress, grassroots organization that started up in opposition to the drilling proposed for the Finger Lakes National Forest.
Okay, well, maybe you can just talk a little bit about what's being proposed and what the timetable is for that.
The proposal is anywhere upwards from 15 to 32 gas wells within the 16,000-acre national forest, which is the smallest national forest in the country. It's the only national forest in New York State, and it's one of the youngest national forests. It's only 19 years old in federal ownership. And with those 15 to 32 wells, there's an enormous amount of access roads to get to them, pipelines to get the gas out, which is equally or more devastation than the well sites themselves. And The Forest Service has produced a draft environmental impact statement. Right now, they're still taking comments in regard to that until August 1st, and that is more or less our ambition, is to generate as many comments toward that statement as possible by August 1st.
How is the opposition to this, Ben? Where is it coming from? Who's opposed to this?
A lot of local residents and folks from the surrounding area, students from over the hill and Ivy League of Cornell University, and it's spreading statewide and nationwide at this point as more and more people become aware of it. We've gotten support from local government bodies such as the Schuyler County Legislature, the town of Hector, the town of Lodi, and Marty Luster, state assemblyman, Maurice Hinchey, Chuck Schumer, and Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton all have come out opposed to drilling in the National Forest.
So what do you think the prospects are of being able to turn back this proposal?
Well, when it was me and a couple of friends and our dogs sitting on our back porch, it didn't look too good. But that was only 9 weeks ago, so it's really looking pretty positive right now. Things are really turning around for us. Next weekend, we're going to be at Grassroots Music and Arts Festival in Trumansburg, New York. Expect to reach out to 15 to 20,000 folks there and really generate some good positive energy that should carry this thing through.
Okay, maybe we can start by, you could just give your name and tell us why you're opposed to the drilling in the Hector National Forest.
All right, well, I grew up in Lodi up at the north end of the National Forest on a small farm there. And I just recently graduated college at Cornell and decided to move back to the area and bought a piece of property near the National Forest in the town of Hector, where I'm trying to develop a sustainable living space for myself. And it's really strange for me that I see myself trying to take the smaller footprint in the national government right across the street, which is what drew me to the area and helped keep me in this area, which is really strange for rural kids nowadays to go to college and then come back to a poor, depressed rural area like this. But there's something about it I love, and there's something about it I'd like to help protect and save.
Okay, so you forgot to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Alex Highland.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you live here in Hector?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So let's see. So what kinds of harm do you envision this project bringing to the area?
Well, for one thing, one of the things I've studied when I was at Cornell was sustainable forestry and environmental management. And I feel right now that, you know, the forest is finally coming back and approaching a mature stage, which is where we really need to start nurturing it instead of setting it back another 150 years. And so if we want to really have a natural treasure here, we have to really protect it and nurture it and let it develop to its fullest potential instead of bulldozing it and destroying the soil, which takes, you know, it takes forest soils hundreds of years to develop their structural integrity, often longer. And so I really want to see the habitat come back. I want to see the eagles come back. I don't want to see the bulldozers come in. And a lot of the argument is also economic, because I live in the area. There's a huge concern that just the cost of maintaining the roads for the exploration, whether or not they actually find gas, will draw money from the town, and there's a chance that they won't find gas, and then the town's stuck with the bill and has to raise taxes or go bankrupt.
Right. Maybe we can talk a little bit about this issue of the economics of it. I mean, are there any local leaders or local people who live in the area who think that it would be an economic benefit?
No one who's truly informed about it, because the truth is the Federal Leasing Reform Act of 1987, I believe, is the year, sets the limit that the government can charge for mineral extraction at 12.5%. Whereas if blocks of local farmers, especially if they block together and enter into the same contract, will have enough leeway to negotiate the price that they can raise the money, and then instead of 75% of it going back to Washington, 25% staying local, the entire part of whatever portion they negotiate with the gas companies will stay in the area and the local people that they do commerce with.
All right. Well, I guess that's good. Unless you want to add anything else.
I'd just like to say that I'm really inspired by all the people showing up here today, and I hope that everyone out there gets a letter in before August 1st.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Schuyler County. Woo! Woo! Tuesday, we got the town of Hector. Woo! And then we got Mari Cinci, and we got Senator Hillary Clinton. And we think we've got Chuck Schumer, too, but that was just in the New York Daily News, so we're not positive, but we might have Chuck Schumer as well. So, two New York senators. And last night, we got the town of Lodi. So the next moves now are Seneca County, right? Seneca County and Ammo Houghton and George Pataki. So we're going to get them on here. Anybody here from Seneca County?
Yeah!
Nice. Anyone here from Ammo Houghton's district? That's like Hector. I guess here, this is Ammo Houghton's district. And we're all from George Pataki's district, aren't we? So we're all going to write them letters and tell them to oppose this drilling, aren't we? Woo!
I want to say that the Forest Service, I've heard this comment a bunch of times, the Forest Service says, it keeps saying that this is a national forest, not a national park. So we have to, you know, they have to go through this process of considering drilling. But we're here to tell them that this is our land, and we don't want it destroyed. We want it preserved. Thanks.
Okay, so you're in the county legislature in Schuyler County, and what's your name?
Glenn Larson.
Okay, and maybe you can tell our listeners why you oppose this this proposal for the national forest.
I voted that we do not drill here because of the people feeling that they shouldn't do it here, and the people are what I represent. And we can get the energy, which I want, from the private lands, and nobody's going to get their fenders bent about that, but the people who camp up there, the people who want to use it for other recreation, hiking and so forth, they feel it will despoil their pleasure, and so why do it? We can get the energy, which I want, and we can get it on private ground. The private citizens will get the money from it, and why not do it that way?
Now, the vote in the legislature was not unanimous.
No.
No. And so what kinds of reasons and arguments did people give for favoring?
The three that voted, one abstained and two voted against the resolution, and they wanted to wait until the EMC, Environmental Management Committee, gave a report. The rest of us felt that EMC had time enough to do it before this, and to put these people off and have them hanging in limbo was not fair, so we pushed it to do it.
So that report's supposed to not be released for another 6 months or something? Is that?
We might have pushed to get it in 2 weeks, but if you understand the feelings of these people, that was important to me, and so I didn't want to wait for an EMC report that should have been on my desk. And I've seen the impact statement. I've got a copy at my office, and I didn't think that the EMC was going to significantly change that. So, but we were working, to me, I was thinking about an emotional issue rather than an environmental issue.
Right. Good. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, my pleasure.
Martha Twerkins, and I'm the district ranger here on the Finger Lakes National Forest.
Okay, can you tell us what the process is for this, for implementation of this, of these proposals, or for approval of the proposals?
Right now, we're asking for comments on this draft environmental impact statement. What we'll do is we'll gather all those comments together, and we'll respond to each comment in a variety of ways. And then we'll have a final environmental impact statement, and it's called a record of decision, which is where the decision is made. We hope to have that sometime this fall. There's been no decision made yet, so if the decision was to lease and a company were to actually bid on the lease and was successful and wanted to drill, we would do another environmental analysis at that time on a site-specific basis. So we hope to have a decision on the leasing probably late fall, and who knows what goes on after that.
What started this whole process? Are there particular companies who are interested in the drilling?
There were two companies that approached the Bureau of Land Management back in late 1998, early 1999, and that's when we started this process of talking to folks about what they think.
And this is fairly common in national forests for this kind of process is this standard practice?
Yeah, national forests are multiple use. That's our mission, is multiple use, the best, greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of people, providing goods and services to the American people. So, yes, this is an appropriate use. Natural gas is appropriate use of national forests.
Right. So what's your feeling about this, about these people who are in opposition to it? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I think this is great. As I said before, we're trying to get comments. We want to hear what people have to say, and this is a great forum for to do that.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure, we'll be meeting the 24th of July. So all those who want to tell Seneca County to oppose drilling, mark that date on your calendar, 24th of July. We'll be there. 8 o'clock in Waterloo.
County building.
County building. Top floor. So July 24th, county building in Waterloo at 8 p.m., Seneca County Legislature. Let's show up in force.
So maybe you can start telling me your name and who you are.
Sure. Chris, I'm Bob Fitzsimmons. I'm a longtime Schuyler County and Hector resident, longtime user, participant in the forest and all its services and beauty.
Okay, and why are you here today?
Well, I feel very strongly that the forest, the National Forest, is a part of a sacred trust of the American people, and that as local residents, we have a special sacred responsibility to protect it and speak out loudly to make sure that it gets preserved in a sense that will be appreciated by our children and our grandchildren.
So how does this proposal threaten the national forest?
Well, Chris, I don't know if you've gotten a chance to ride up to Lodi Center and take a look at what a gas well drilling operation is really like. It's floodlit, it's clear-cut, it's 24/7, it's huge, it's noisy, it's dirty, it's heavy trucks, it's pipes, it's massive, intensive, and pervasive, and very, very dominating and ugly. It does not fit in with a mixed-use, balanced philosophy and approach of forest management in a forest of 16,000 acres. Now, out west where they have million-acre forests, maybe you could see doing some mining and some drilling there and come up with an argument that for effective energy management, that would be an appropriate land use. You can't possibly reach that conclusion in this forest, the only national forest in the state of New York and the smallest national forest of all in America.
Okay. One more question about. I was speaking to the fellow from the Schuyler County Legislature, and
yes.
He said that he's not worried about the energy supply because people can do drilling on private lands around mm-hmm. here. Are going to see a lot of the same effects mm-hmm. if that drilling yeah. goes on in private
yeah.
lands.
Yeah, interesting, Chris. That's an excellent point. But what I see is that sure, my neighbors put in vineyards too. They build businesses. They put up driveways. You know, but. The land that we share is the national forest. The whole point and intent is to create something that's sacred, that we preserve for time immemorial, something that we have a passionate, sacred attitude toward, that we recognize as a holy place and one that's worth preserving for all future generations. Now, my neighbors who want to drill on their property, I understand that. In terms of where we're going with our energy policy, I think it's totally whacked, totally out of line, totally full of nonsense and hypocrisy.
You mean nationwide?
Our nationwide policy.
How is this connected with the larger?
I think there's a ton of them. You know, whether you're looking at the Arctic drilling question, which the Senate has said no go to Mr. Bush, whether you look at Florida and the no go Mr. Bush, or at least a dramatic change in what's permitted to be drilled, even by his own brother, whether you look at the House of Representatives vote, you know, which is not known for being a liberal bastion of forest protection, but they're saying no go here. So, you know, this is an issue that cuts way across party lines now. It's a Republican issue, a Democrat issue, a Green issue, certainly, but it's one where people from all walks of life, and even as you look around here, you see business people, young people, older people, who are saying this is something the mass of American thinking agrees on. The vast majority of Americans want national forests and parklands protected and held sacrosanct from development. We're included in that group, and we want this forest included in that thinking.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chris.
That was Chris Sturr speaking with attendees of last week's rally against the proposal to drill for oil and gas in the Finger Lakes National Forest. The plan to drill in the National Forest has ramifications not only for the forest itself, but for our way of life here in the Finger Lakes. I have a personal perspective I'd like to share with you. It's a cautionary tale. I moved here from Los Angeles a little over 2 years ago. For those who have never been to Los Angeles, the glimpses of palm tree-lined beaches and Beverly Hills mansions seen in movies represent a small fraction of the reality. Many people in Seneca County are familiar with the strip of the 520 between the villages of Waterloo and Seneca Falls. For those who aren't, it's a wasteland containing Walmart, fast food joints, car dealers, garish plastic signs, billboards, and parking lots. Imagine an area larger than Seneca County that looks just like that, and then add brown air and continual traffic jams. Imagine a place where people have to drive 4 hours through traffic each day to work, and those who can actually afford to own a home at all are in the minority. Imagine driving from Syracuse to Rochester and never leaving the city. That is Los Angeles. Some call this prosperity. I call it hell. Los Angeles was once a relatively small city surrounded by farms. In the middle of the last century, oil was discovered. First came the wells and the pumps, then the refineries that destroyed what were once rural communities. Once an area has been made ugly and dirty with this sort of activity, The original people have been driven out, and there's little opposition to more of the same. This process has been repeated in countless areas all over this country. We must not let it happen here. The damage will not be restricted to the 16,000 acres of the National Forest. It will spread to overtake vast portions of Seneca and Schuyler counties. What we are fighting for here is not just the National Forest. We're fighting for our sparkling lakes, clean air, green fields, small farms, and our pretty little towns. We, the people of the Finger Lakes, need to take our own destiny in our hands and develop the kinds of economic and social structures that will preserve our rural way of life. The government in Washington, D.C. is nothing but a petrochemical cartel and can only affect us in a negative way. We have the option to organize ourselves to create our own clean energy sources through wind, solar, and biomass that can peacefully coexist with farming and tourism. We can create cooperatives and alternative financial institutions that will keep the money in our communities instead of extracting it for the benefit of Wall Street investors. This effort to drill in the National Forest is part of a much larger constellation of issues that we must address if we want to preserve our region and avoid victimization by carpetbaggers in the name of development. Some people in our community don't seem to value the riches we do have. These riches, once destroyed, can't be bought back by any amount of money. If you love the Finger Lakes, please, please help stop the drilling. The Seneca County Legislature will meet on July 24th at 8 p.m. That's this coming Tuesday at the County Building off Route 414 just north of the 5 and 20 in Waterloo. An endorsement against the drilling will be sought. It's urgent that Seneca County residents who oppose the drilling attend. Also, the Forest Service needs to hear from us by August 1st in writing. Here is the address. Finger Lakes National Forest, Attention, Oil and Gas, DEIS, Comments, 5218, State Route 414, Hector, New York, 14841. Again, that is Finger Lakes National Forest, Attention, Oil and Gas, DEIS, Comments, and that DEIS stands for the Draft Environmental Impact Statement. 5218 State Route 414, Hector, New York, 14841. In order for your comments to be considered, they must refer to one of the alternatives. In this case, the producers of this program are encouraging that you refer to alternative number 4, no action is what they call it, which means no drilling. And your statement must include your name and address in full. The Finger Lakes Sierra Club, which has also endorsed alternative number 4, no action, no drilling, has provided a phone number you can call for more information on the issue and other related issues. Contact Amanda Schnoor at area code 607-277-4061. That's Amanda Schnoor, 607-277-4061.
Charge the people $1.50 just to see 'em. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Go, that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
There's another urgent matter requiring action to avert disaster. We're at a crucial moment in the battle to stop the approval of the appropriation of land for the Geneva Biotech Park. This facility would allow Cornell and its corporate partners to do open field trials of undisclosed genetic engineering experiments that will introduce a host of never-before-seen-in-nature organisms into our environment. In one known example of near disaster that has come to light, which we reported on several shows ago, in the early 90s, the EPA was weeks away from approving a GMO microorganism that would have turned any soil it touched into a desert by converting the soil's organic matter into alcohol, a medium in which plants cannot grow. A graduate student's project fortuitously uncovered this side effect, which had been overlooked both by the creators and regulators. As an experimental facility, the Geneva Ag Biotech Park would not even be subject to our inadequate regulatory agencies. The enabling legislation that would authorize the land for the facility is still penned up in the Assembly Rules Committee, which is chaired by Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver. But the next possible vote on it is this coming Tuesday. Because the Assembly is only meeting sporadically right now, if we can keep the bill from passing next week, maybe we can buy some time. If you have access to a fax machine, please fax Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver before Tuesday and let him know that there is strong opposition to the biotech park and that Cornell is refusing to disclose to the public the nature of its experiments. The faxes should go to Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver at area code 518-455-5459, that's in Albany. The bill in question is 9206A. Technically, this bill enables a land swap, but that's just what Cornell needs to get going. Again, the fax number is 518-455-5459. If you don't have access to a fax, then please call Sheldon Silver's office at area code 518-455-3791 and ask him to prevent the authorization of the land swap for the Ag Biotech Park in Geneva. The panel we are about to hear, Who Owns Science, took place last March at the Harvard School of Public Health in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The presentations make clear the incompatibility of scientific research and corporate profit. Of particular relevance in terms of projects like the proposed Geneva Biotech Park. The refusal of Cornell to reveal the nature of the experiments that it conducts in our midst, hiding behind the excuse of proprietary relationships, is a demonstration close to home of the way that privatization of science is impacting society.
I want to welcome you all here this evening. My name is Bill Ravenacy. I'm the Boston Campaign Director for Healthcare Without Harm. We're hopeful that many of you had the opportunity last evening to view the Bill Moyers special, Trade Secrets. For those of you who haven't had the opportunity to watch the program, I'd like to say a few words about it. In Trade Secrets, a Moyers report, correspondent Bill Moyers and producer Sherry Jones uncovered how our health and safety have been put at risk and why the chemical industry doesn't want the truth to be known. This investigative report, accompanied by the PBS.org website, is based on a massive archive of secret industry documents as shocking as the tobacco papers. And if you'd like to see any of those documents, they are now online at the EW, Environmental Working Group, EWG.org website. At its core, the Moyers Show asks a deeply troubling question. With more than 75,000 synthetic chemicals having been released into the environment, what happens as our bodies absorb them, and how can we protect ourselves? As part of the report, Moyers took tests designed to measure the synthetic chemicals in his body, a measurement known as chemical body burdens. The blood tests bring the findings of Moyers' documentary chillingly close to home. Trade Secrets provides everyone working on toxic chemicals and environmental health issues a tremendous education and outreach opportunity. To help maximize that opportunity, the Environmental Health Fund the Environmental Working Group, and I think you probably, for those who viewed the program last night, saw Ken Cook from the Environmental Working Group, the president of that environmental organization. The Center for Health, Environmental Justice, and the Women's Voices for the Earth have launched Coming Clean, an action network, a project aimed at cleaning up the chemical industry's contamination of our food, our bodies, and our environment. Let me add a poignant quote by the author, Edward Abbey. Quote, "Sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul," end quote. So here's a few ways to blend sentiment and action. You can send a message to Congress on our website, www.comeclean.org. You can also use the website to sign up for monthly updates on what you can do to get the chemical industry to come clean. We want the chemical industry executives to come clean before Congress and reveal the secrets that they are withholding from the American public. We want to clean up the pollution of science and regulatory policy that chemical industry has accomplished over the last 30 years. And we want to clean up the products we use every day so that they don't contain dangerous chemicals. I would be somewhat remiss if I didn't wind up here with a Bill Moyers quote. And I quote, "If workers, the public, journalists, and government regulators had known what the industry knew about the health risk of its products, when the industry knew it, our laws today might be profoundly more protective of human health than they are," end quote. I'd like to take a moment now to introduce and to turn the evening over to our moderator for the panel discussion, the thinking man's pundit, a man who has worked tirelessly on toxics use reduction. He is a professor of work environment at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell, where he teaches environmental and occupational health policy. At the university, he also serves as the director of the Massachusetts Toxics Use Reduction Institute and acts as the co-director for the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ken Geiser.
Before I open this evening and turn this over to what I think is just a remarkable panel that's been brought together this evening, I'd like to say a few words myself about my own reaction to last night. Last night's PBS special was certainly impressive. We learned about the hazards of a gigantic industry devoted to materials development. Not only did we get a glimpse of how dangerous some of the products are, but we also saw how much more hazardous these substances have become because of corporate efforts to withhold research findings, misinterpret information, and lobby to resist public oversight. And yet, as impressive as the show was, I was struck at how dated it seemed. We were left with the impression that more chemical testing and more right-to-know data access are the true solutions. We need to test chemicals more. We need to test human bodies for burden more. We need to study systemic and synergistic chemical effects more. And we need to warn workers, communities, and citizens about the hazards of the chemical industry. We need more health science, fair and independent science to be sure, but more health science just the same. Now, I would agree that we need more fair and independent science, and that is really the subject of tonight's really remarkable panel. But the science that I believe we need more of is actually not represented so well on this panel, and that's the material sciences. Please understand, if over the next decade we rely only on our health sciences, we will certainly know more about the condition of our health and the multiple ways that we are victims of the chemical industry and its products. But teaching people about how they are victimized has never been enough to move them toward fundamental solutions that could really, truly enhance their life prospects. During the 1990s, we fought long and hard for right-to-know provisions in this country. And during the 1990s, we struggled hard for chemical testing. Of course, we certainly do need more chemical testing and more data, but those are old battles. No, the sciences that we are now so underdeveloped are not the sciences of analysis, but the sciences of solutions. We need to develop sciences that provide alternatives to the barrage of poisonous chemicals that have been unleashed upon us by a chemical industry eager to reap profits from the waste streams of the petroleum industry. We need chemical, physical, and biological sciences that mine our understanding of human health and the functioning of the planetary environment to replace the toxic and hazardous materials of today with a new generation of safer and cleaner materials that do not poison us as they benefit us. We need to move beyond studies of how damaged we are. Instead, we need to use that same knowledge to help us phase out the production and use of carcinogens, reproductive toxins, mutagens, endocrine disruptions, and allergens, and replace them with materials that are more comfortably fit into the ecological systems of the planet. Indeed, in 1989, Massachusetts was one of the few places in the world that took a bold initiative to directly confront the use of toxic chemicals. As many of you know, in that year, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts established the State Toxics Use Reduction Program to promote the reduction in the use of hundreds of toxic chemicals and in their waste streams. This law required the state's largest polluting firms to report annually on the use of toxic chemicals and to plan on reducing or eliminating their use. The law empowered the Department of Environmental Protection, the Office of Technology Assessment, and the Toxics Use Reduction Institute at the University of Massachusetts to work with over 900 firms to identify and implement toxics use reduction strategies. That program is now a decade old. Last year, the state reported that over a nine-year period, the amount of toxic chemicals released as waste from those firms has been cut by 48%. And the amount of chemicals used in Massachusetts, toxic chemicals used in Massachusetts, has been cut by a third, even as the economy has grown. Indeed, an independent evaluation of the program has shown that many firms actually increased the amount of money they made because of changes in their toxic chemical configurations. This was not merely an engineering feat. It required those of us in government, in communities, and industry not simply to document the hazards of toxic chemicals, but to identify their potential alternatives and to seek to implement the least harmful amongst them. In Europe, this approach has often been called the precautionary approach. A precautious approach reorganizes the way we think about science. Under this intellectual system, we use a more holistic, multidisciplinary, and inclusive approach to gather data and interpret it. We shift the burden of risk from those who would propose hazardous, shift the burden of risk onto those who would propose hazardous behaviors, and we seek to prevent harm long before the tumors are formed, the DNA is damaged, and the bodies are accumulated. So I would like to open this panel tonight with a friendly challenge to my colleagues. My challenge is to consider not only how science may be manipulated and corrupted by the short-term interests of corporations, speculators, and political opportunists, but to consider what kind of science will be needed if we are to move beyond simply documenting our endangerment and commit ourselves to a science that truly guarantees a safer and healthier world. With those comments, I have the wonderful privilege of turning this over to people that I have, some of whom I've shared podiums with many times and have great respect for. It's an honor for me to serve as a moderator with you all tonight. So with that, I'm going to turn this over, and it is my honor to introduce Shelley, or Professor Sheldon Krimsky, who I had a wonderful several years of teaching with at Tufts. He is a professor of urban and environmental policy at Tufts University. His research is focused on the linkage between science, technology, ethical values, and public policy. He is the author of 6 books, including a recent book entitled Hormonal Chaos. He was a consultant to the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical and Behavioral Research, and to the Congressional Office of Technology. Please welcome.
In my short time, I have 3 things I'd like to raise with you. First, I'd like to discuss the background behind the changes in the industry support of university research and how it's been shaping in the last couple of decades. Second, I'd like to talk about the impact of these changes on the GNRP. That's the Gross National Research Product of the universities. And of major research universities. And third, I'd like to talk about briefly about the effects of these changes of industrial funding on the university on the impacts on scientific research all in a few minutes. So let me start then with the background, and we can put the first slide on. Many of you may be familiar with some of the policies that the government has issued since 1980, over two decades. These policies have been responsible for the creation of partnerships between industry and universities. As a matter of fact, the government has tried to create as many incentives as possible to open up the universities for industrial colonization, research, partnerships. And as a result, you can see, for example, in 1980, the patenting of genes made it possible for every molecular geneticist who was doing any sequencing to be an entrepreneur, because every sequence was worth a patent. So that opened up a great amount of entrepreneurship in all of modern molecular genetics. We go on to the next one. In 1980, the tax laws were changed to create incentives for industry to invest in universities. I'm not going to go through all of them, but the one that should be highlighted is the Bayh-Dole Act, because that was the case where the government said that when we give government funds for research, we would like the university to be able to take those funds and then partner with a private company. So basically, we will sell out the developments of privately funded research so that private companies and a university can profit for them. And that's created an enormous incentives for companies to engage with universities. So public policy has had a major effect in creating the rapid commercialization of university science. Now, some of the impacts of this. Can I have the second slide, please? This second slide, it's a lot of data. It's fairly new. I just generated it myself from the National Science Foundation raw information. The first 10 universities are the top industrially funded universities, and I threw in Harvard at the bottom, which is not in the top 10 industrially funded, because I figured since this is the host institution, I should have some comparative statistics. But you'll notice in the top 10 universities, the percent change of industry-funded R&D between 1992 and 1999 for Duke University, which is the leader, was 280%, which was the change of the industry R&D. And the change of the total R&D over that period was 84%. You can see on the right column, it represents the total percentage of industry R&D over the total R&D. And for a place like Duke, that's 34% of its budget, of its GNRP, is now industry funded. You'll see at the bottom that Harvard is only 3.6%. So depending upon whether you see this as a positive or a negative, there's some interesting implications here. A number of the other universities also have percentages of rises that are well above the 100% figure. Can you put the next slide on, which I think has some more visual graphics? Those graphs represent the percent changes in industry versus university R&D, and you can see the solid line represents the changes in industry-funded R&D, and you can see the enormity of those changes, and based upon, as I said, some of the public policies and some of the initiatives of the university. The next slide, please. Finally, this third of a series here shows the percent of industry-funded R&D in universities compared to the total R&D. And you can see, again, 35% for Duke. MIT is at the 17% figure, Georgia Tech Institute, close to 25%. And these figures are rising. So then the next question is, what's the significance of having more of your R&D come from outside the university? Here I'd like to put up a few slides now. The government began to get concerned about this in the 1980s. There were a few hearings. Is science for sale, conflicts of interest versus the public interest? Please put up the next one. Scientific misconduct and conflicts of interest hazardous to our health? The past decade has shown an enormous concern about the conflicts of interest that have arisen in university research, and the government constantly is trying to pass new regulations or new standards for this. Pass the next one, please. This is a study that was done by David Blumenthal of Harvard University. It gives you an idea of what some of the impacts are of these collaborations. This is a study, New England Journal, in which 30% reported, these are 210 senior executives, 30% reported that conflicts of interest developed when the academic institutions became involved with another company. 12% reported that there had been misconduct, concerned that there had been misconduct in the research. More than 50% said the research they supported in universities is often or sometimes a confidential trade secrets to protect proprietary information. And many reported that students had to keep the information confidential. Next slide, please. So you see some of the media articles. Gifts to science researchers have strings attached. Next, please. And now we begin to see the bottom line here. Are we going to be seeing bias in the research that is eventually populated by industry funding? Many people have argued that science stands beyond this type of thing, that scientists pursue the truth independent of where their research funding comes from. But there is a small body of research that's beginning to show that the funding for the research does seem to matter. These studies are primarily in the area of drugs, pharmaceuticals, because it seems to be easier to do that work for those studies because there's a lot of repetitive studying that goes on in the drug sector. So in this case, we have bias in drug studies. One of the most important studies was the study on calcium channel antagonists, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, 1998. Next slide, please. That was discussed in this particular article. In that case, what the authors did was they studied scientists, medical researchers, who studied calcium channel antagonists, but who fit into two categories, some who were funded by industry and some who were funded by non-private sectors. And they found there was quite a significant difference in how those individuals, scientists, came out on these particular drugs. And it indicated at least one of the explanations that accounts for this is that the support by private corporations for drug testing can affect one's interpretation of the data or the outcome of the research. Is that the last? Yeah. So there's a number of other studies from 1972 to 1996. There have been 10 studies done looking at prescribing behavior of doctors and where they get their information about drugs. All 10 studies in that period of time have shown a correlation between getting information from commercial sources and less appropriate prescribing behavior. So there is a body of research that's building up, which indicates that the source of funding can matter, and if you start to increase the GNRP of the major universities and tip them toward much more private interest, we may see major changes in the type of research we're going to get.
Our next speaker, Dr. Richard Clapp, has done enormous services to many, many communities in this country by bringing public health information to people who don't have access to academic settings. He received his master's in public health from this very high school here, and his doctor of science in epidemiology from BU School of Public Health. He is a member of several professional organizations and currently serves as vice president of the steering committee of the Greater Boston Physicians for Social Responsibility. He is currently on the faculty as an associate professor at the School of Public Health in the Environmental Health Department. It's a pleasure to have Richard Clapp.
I wanted to talk not really about the influence of industry on funding universities or funding research in universities, but really the industry influence on an agency. I'm really going to just tell a story. I have no transparencies, and I have no bottom line. This is a story that's still going on, and it's about the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency's, reassessment of dioxin, the health effects and the implications of exposures to people in this country to dioxin. This is a process, this reassessment of the EPA's position on dioxin started 10 years ago. And it was really instituted because of pressure by industry on then Secretary of Environmental, the administrator, I think, of the Environmental Protection Agency, William Riley, in 1991. The American Paper Institute, API, and the Chemical Manufacturers Association pressured then Administrator Riley to begin reassessing the EPA's position on how toxic dioxin was, because there had been a prior conference about a year earlier that suggested that the mechanism by which dioxin may exert all its influence was through a receptor, the so-called AH receptor. And what this implies is, if you follow this through, is that there may be a threshold or a safe level below which exposure to dioxin would not be expected to have any health effects in humans. So that development, I guess you would say, in the scientific community led the industry organizations to pressure then, this was under Bush the First, the administrator of the EPA under Bush the First, Riley, to instigate this process. And it was supposed to be a year and a half long. This was supposed to be completed by, say, the end of 1993. Well, it's been 10 years. It's nowhere near, well, it's getting near completion. I wouldn't hazard to estimate when it's going to be completed. And I was asked at a couple of points along the way to participate. I did some of my research at Boston University on Agent Orange, Vietnam veterans and the cancers, actually, that Vietnam veterans got compared to other veterans. And the exposure of interest in Vietnam, for cancer at least, was herbicide spraying and especially the dioxin contaminants. So because of that, I was asked by the EPA staff to review the chapter for this reassessment on epidemiology, basically just to give them informal advice as to whether the chapter was complete and whether there were major things left out or stated wrong and so forth, which I did without pay. As some people say, a lot of no good deed goes unpunished. This was one that did not go unpunished. I spent a lot of time on this and then submitted my comments to the EPA staff person. And then about a year later, in 1995, the EPA Science Advisory Board was charged with the task of reviewing what the EPA agency had come up with, a multi-volume, eight-volume, foot-high dioxin reassessment. And so the Science Advisory Board, which is supposed to be scientists outside the agency, which advised the agency on scientific questions, convened a panel, subcommittee, to review the dioxin reassessment that had been released in draft in 1994. So in the 1995 SAB meeting, which was held at a hotel in, you know, some godforsaken town in Virginia near Dulles Airport, one of these, you know, whatever you call it, pressure cooker type consultants hotel, about 20 of us convened that were either Science Advisory Board members. This panel was made up of both members of the Science Advisory Board and then consultants who have some special knowledge or expertise that are brought in. And in that first panel, I think there were about five Science Advisory Board members, which sort of covered a range of skills and expertise. Actually broke into two groups. One was focusing on exposure, and how estimates of exposure are made, and the other is on health effects and what are the implications of exposures in terms of human health. I was on that latter panel or subcommittee. And then we met in a room, like a Holiday Inn type hotel, in a conference room with a round or a big semicircle table, the 20 of us that were considering the health effects. And then rows of it looked to me like Gucci Gulch. You know, the industry consultants were sitting there with their very shiny shoes and suits and ties mostly, taking notes, furiously taking notes. And then there was a period of public comment during this 1995 meeting at this hotel, and person after person who stood up to make comments said, I'm representing the American Paper Institute, or I'm here for the consulting group called Environ, and we are here presenting a panel at the request of the American Forest Products Association, one industry organization after another, basically, and a few oddballs, I must say, also spoke at this. And then the EPA panel considered all this input, discussed amongst ourselves what we thought the scientific evidence showed at that time and how well the EPA had reflected that in their documents, and then drafted a statement that was supposed to be the Science Advisory Board panel's view of the EPA draft reassessment document. And that was done. And I must say the panel was overwhelmingly favorable toward the industry comments that had come from the floor. I mean, this is my own feeling, watching the members of the panel, sitting next to members of the panel, hearing sort of sidebar comments, that the industry comments from the floor were meeting a basically favorable review from this subcommittee sitting around. And so as a result, the Science Advisory Board document that's supposed to summarize these subcommittee members' comments was very negative, and in fact, I would say trashed the EPA's scientific reassessment.